Welcome to the Sales Enablement Innovation Podcast, brought to you by the Sales Enablement Collective. Each episode, we sit down with sales enablement and revenue leaders from around the world and invite them to share their expertise and experience with the community. On this episode, we spoke with Jeff Jaworski about sales coaching and the shifts you can make to help your sales team succeed. I hope you enjoy our conversation. On the show today is Jeff Jaworski. Hi, Jeff. Thanks so much for taking the time to join me on the show today.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
And so before we sort of kick things off, do you want to sort of introduce yourself, run through your background, your experience,
yeah,
and sort of how you've gotten to this point in your career?
Yeah, you got it. Yeah. Hey to everyone watching. I have about 20 plus years of space sitting, frankly, at all sides of the table. So I spent nearly a decade as an executive buyer on the agency side before transitioning to Google and spending about 13 years at Google, both as a frontline seller and sales leader, as well as 5 years in enablement, leading our global enablement strategy, and then most recently running my own business in this domain over the past, say, 7-8 months. So excited to be here and share my experience.
That's awesome. And I mean, you know, great background, great CV, exactly sort of what we sort of want to pull in on the podcast. We're sort of going to be talking about sales coaching and sort of attitudes towards sales coaching in today's episodes. But I want to start by asking you, how do you sort of define sales coaching? What does that mean? Because there might be sort of different people have different definitions and sort of different particularities about sort of how they would define it. So what does sales coaching mean to you?
Yeah, great question, great lead up. So a couple things. One, you know, as part of my background at Google, I founded and built what we called Coaching My Mastery, which was a dedicated sales coaching program that serviced and supported thousands of sellers and managers across the globe. So this was a constant for us as we thought about building the program. For me, in its definition, if you start with the word coaching is really about truly like unlocking the full potential of a person, regardless of what you're kind of supporting them in. You then add the sales layer to that, and then it really gets into how do I best support and unlock the full potential of a seller when they're working through a key deal or they're a discovery call or how to handle an objection. And really the biggest piece of that from a coaching lens is really predicated on making sure that we are not simply just telling sellers and managers what we think they should do, and really helping them uncover and unlock the right kind of solutions to address themselves, but also applying the right sets of kind of like frameworks and instruction, if you will, so that they know simple, tangible, repeatable ways to do certain things. For example, you know, how we would expect them to handle an objection going into discovery, being able to properly diffuse that and then deliver a response and solution as an example.
That's really interesting. That sort of leads me into my next question, which was, I guess, you mentioned managers there. How do you work with managers when you are sort of coaching sales reps? Is it sort of enablement acting as a middleman or vice versa? So how do you sort of set that up? Because I think some people maybe find it difficult to find the balance between the sales managers do all the coaching and enablement's doing all the coaching. So how do you sort of view that sort of dynamic, I guess?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the way I look at it simply is it's an and, not an or. However, what's interesting is when we started building out our business case at Google to build out the coaching program, the number one kind of objection we heard that I was frankly prepared for was, well, wait a second, why would we create a coaching program when that's the manager's job? And my answer to that was, I agree. However, two things are true in most cases. Number one, managers have a lot of jobs, right? There's a lot of things they're doing. They're an operator. They, you know, have a quota to kind of hit, et cetera, et cetera. Coach is one part of what they're asked to do amongst many different things. And number two is even if a manager believes they're coaching their team, there's a very high likelihood they've not been properly trained in it and they're not actually coaching them. They're just telling them what to do. So those two things in combination were an opportunity for us, one, to say, let's create some specialism in the how we coach our sellers, frankly, and our managers. And then we actually brought managers into the program as well. And that gave us an opportunity to kind of raise the floor and the ceiling, if you will, because then the managers understood and were trained on how do you properly coach your sales folks. And we would have them coach sellers outside of their core team, but also then better coach the sellers that were on their team and saw really significant results from that. So I'd say the main piece is for those listening to this, thinking about coaching for their organization potentially, this is not an or, this is really an and. Like, think about how you can bring the managers along in this as well.
That's really interesting. And I like that idea of actually bringing the managers in and leveling up sort of what they're doing, sort of they're actually, it's almost a multifaceted program in what it's bringing, which is really interesting. I want to bring it back to, at our event in Chicago, Sales Enablement Summit, you spoke about sort of key shifts to make in order to drive higher performing revenue teams and sales teams.
Yeah.
And you put out an article last week that was really good as well, sort of exploring those. For maybe someone who hasn't sort of read the article or wasn't able to attend in Chicago, would you mind sort of explaining sort of what those shifts are and how you view them? We'll link the article in the description of this as well if
yeah.
you want to read that. But you sort of explore those, because there were sort of five really sort of distinct and important points, and I think it's important to be able to share those with our sort of podcast audience as well.
Yeah, you got it. Yeah, in its simplest form, and there's a talk version of this, to your point, in an article to read later, but the five key shifts as I see them and I've experienced them to drive higher performing teams and especially utilizing sales coaching are, you know, number one, we've got to really lean much more into the how, not just the what. So a lot of sellers, we focus a lot on the, you know, product knowledge and information and things that they need to know to like tell their customers and prospects. But we don't focus enough on the actual skills that they need to then flow through the proper motion, be able to handle an objection, do an effective discovery call, run an effective meeting, et cetera. So number one was, you know, really leaning into the how and understanding the skills and capabilities and behaviors you're trying to drive with your sales force, and not over lean on the knowledge and, you know, the tell, right? So that's the most important one. The where it flows from an enablement perspective from there is when we get into shift number two, we talk about moving away from compliance and really changing behavior. So what happens in enablement a lot is we focus a lot on, you know, get everyone trained on X, Y, or Z within a given period of time. The risk that that runs is that becomes a compliance exercise. Check, I got 85% of people to do X, Y, or Z. By the time we agree to do that, what usually happens is then sellers and managers complete that task begrudgingly because they have to get it done, and they do it at the end of the quarter when it's actually much more important for them to be in front of customers closing, selling, gap closing, etc., and instead they're spending time on training, right? So really thinking about how do we move away from this like compliance exercise and bring it into something that is truly changing behavior and improving outcomes, which leads us to, you know, the next couple, which is, you know, number three is really being you know, more so doing it for them where they see the benefit versus them feeling like this need that they have to do it. So going back to that deadline piece of when they go through a sales coaching session, ideally, you know, one of my coaches would say all the time, we can get you from awkward to awesome in 60 minutes, right? So in an ideal space, you go through a coaching session, it doesn't really feel like training. What it feels like is, wow, like I went through this, you know, I kind of worked through the hiccups and the bumps, and then coming out of it, I feel much more confident and capable to go deliver when it matters most in front of the actual customer, not practicing in front of them, right? So making sure it really feels like it's something that's happening for them. To do that effectively, we have to shift away from a space where we're saying, oh, our program's ready, our workshops are ready, come when we're ready for you and enroll in these things, and really make these things much more in their flow of work. So instead of it being in the enablement team's flow, make it more so in the flow of the seller manager's work, meaning they should be able to sign up for a coaching session, they should be able to request a team workshop or a team practice session, and we should be able to be available for them at their time of need throughout the flow of their work and more always on, which, you know, a big risk and kind of challenge we face in enablement is teams spend a lot of time building things, and then you have to wait, you know, 3-6 months before you bring out a program. And then a lot of times what they also do is they don't build or deploy things in Q4 because sellers are too busy. That's actually a time when sales coaching is critical because that's sometimes the most important quarter. And then not a lot's happening in Q1 because we're too busy finalizing our plans, doing SEO and building things to launch in Q2, right? Where I would push us to like remove the reliance on the proverbial Gantt chart and think about things that always need to be true, which leads me to the last piece, which is really being in it with the sales organization and not just throwing things at them, right? So in a lot of cases, I know this sounds common sense, but enablement and sales are sitting like this. Sales has things they need to do. Enablement has things they believe they need to do. They're throwing things over to sales. Sales, again, might do these things because they're told they must do them. The approach we took to really reframe and reshift that was take a page out of the sales team's book. We would do joint business plans. In enablement, we created joint learning plans so that both sides agreed what are the biggest priorities we need to focus on so that we have mutually agreeable outcomes and then clear measurement behind that to say this is something both sides feels important, and we could check in on those things and make sure if it's not tracking well, we know we both already agreed to it versus them feeling like, well, we're not tracking wellness because we actually don't care about this, right? So the governance, the steering, the alignment is really important as well. So that's the five shifts in, you know, a very short couple minutes.
That's really awesome. First of all, thank you for sort of running through those. And there's a lot of sort of really interesting points to take out of that. I think that the first one I'm thinking of sort of our audience as well is made up of just as many sort of small enablement teams or small organizations as large ones. And so maybe some of the larger organizations with more resources and maybe more a little bit more manpower might find it easier to sort of apply those sort of principles and those sort of shifts. Do you have sort of any recommendations for smaller teams, maybe 1, 2, 3 person enablement teams, on how they can sort of balance everything they're doing sort of to shift that mentality and get all the benefits that you sort of outlined, but sort of doing it within a scalable, manageable scope for a team of their size?
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, in its simplest form, and I did this for another talk recently, so I'll share it here too. In its simplest form, like let me give you another play on SKO, right? So we know SKO is sales kickoff. SKO also is skills plus knowledge equals outcomes. Regardless of the size of your enablement team, the most important thing then is to work backwards and say, what is the outcome we are trying to drive for our sellers or managers? And then what do they need to know and do to be able to drive that outcome? If you're a smaller enablement team, what I would encourage you to think about is like even identify like what's the one most important outcome for us to start with, and then how do we more as simply as possible bring them the knowledge and skills they need to be able to deliver against that outcome, right? As an example, during my time at Google, which was a large enablement organization and a large company, as we know, we obsessed over one outcome, which was driving more effective meetings. And we knew the more effective the meeting was, and if we raised our partner satisfaction rates, that would drive more revenue. So I would encourage anyone watching this, take a step back and say, what is the most important outcome we need to drive that enablement could support? And then within that, what do we need to make sure the audience that's going to engage in this needs to be able to know and do effectively to drive that outcome? Then you can get into, you know, what are some simple, scalable, repeatable ways that we can do that? And I could tell you with confidence, you don't need a, you know, 50, 100 person enablement organization to do those things. In some cases, you can do it, you know, at scale through, you know, kind of live learning experiences, et cetera, job aids in the flow of work, et cetera, you know, things of that nature. But there's also, you know, with the AI revolution, like there's a lot of great technologies out there that you can actually, you know, allow people to kind of get coaching practice and feedback in the flow of their work always on using AI. So I would just encourage folks to think about where can you be, you know, kind of agile in that space when you don't have as large of a team.
That makes a lot of sense. I really appreciate the sort of depth of that answer. And that sort of brings me on to sort of my next question, which was, I guess, in terms of sort of implementing these programs and, you know, taking these principles to heart, how do you then measure that sort of the success? How do you decide it worked? Is it a sort of mentality change? Are you looking at sort of specific metrics and numbers of improvement? You mentioned a sort of increase in meeting quality. How are you sort of quantifying that, I guess, and sort of you have a sort of number that you're sort of chasing in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, overall measurement, we've adopted, and I'm a big believer in the Kirkpatrick model, which gets you into the different levels of, you know, were they satisfied? Are they more confident? Are they more capable? You move your way up the chain, behavior change, and then ideally level 4, which I know a lot of people talk about, is the hardest one to get to, which is business impact, right? So the key piece is you know, look at the Kirkpatrick model and you say, within a given program, how far up the chain can I get with an ambition to get to business impact? When we were doing this at Google and focused on meeting effectiveness, we knew that meeting effectiveness improvement actually correlated to revenue. We did some stuff on the back end that showed us correlation. So what we focused on was actually measuring and tracking meeting effectiveness. And, you know, some of it was survey-based in the sense of we would ask sellers and managers a bunch of questions on understanding objectives, meeting effectiveness, things of that nature. But then we also asked the customer. And then what that allowed us to identify and understand was a couple of things. One, is there a perception gap? Because in a lot of cases, sellers actually felt like all these things were going great, but then customers didn't necessarily agree. So we had a gap to close there. And in some cases, the gap actually grew the more senior and experienced the seller was, right? So we had to kind of identify, how do we make sure we're supporting, you know, regardless of level and tenure, this wasn't, you know, our senior folks are fine. Like, we really knew it applied to everybody. And then by tracking the improvement in meeting effectiveness, which we did see, and the partner satisfaction, we knew there was a correlation to revenue. The last piece I'd add to that is, you know, through your CRM data, if you're doing specific programs, you can link these things together, right? So when you're working on a particular deal, you could actually like tag that deal and say, hey, this deal's going through coaching. These deals didn't go through coaching. Are we seeing any kind of differentials? Are we seeing, you know, higher pitch and win rates? Are the deal sizes larger? Is the time to close faster? Then you can get into real tangible things that would tell you, like, is coaching actually driving business impact?
That's really interesting. I really like that last point of sort of the comparison piece, because that's almost the most stark sometimes, isn't it, in terms of really seeing the difference between the coached deal and the one that hasn't been, which is really interesting. And you sort of touched on it earlier, but it sort of came to mind there as well. In terms of sort of using sort of technology to measure that as well, are you using sort of call recording tools? That sort of, do you see sort of value in using both sort of AI and manager sort of call reviews to sort of see how reps can improve sort of within that sort of technological framework there?
Yeah. I won't sponsor any on this podcast, but I will say I'm a huge proponent for that space, right? So, you know, going back to the comment I made about AI, you know, there's some things, and I know there's a lot of conversation about, you know, AI's impact on enablement and things of that nature, but there's things that AI can do that, frankly, humans could have never done anyways, which is simple things like you're on a call with a customer and it's able to kind of play back, you know, usage of filler words, how much time you talked, how many questions did you ask, things of that nature. And then you can use that to hopefully, you know, learn and grow on your own, psychologically safe. It's your data, it's your information, sharing that with you, and then improve for future customer calls or even practice them in advance. Like, there's companies where you can, you know, have an AI coach do that for you. So I'm a huge proponent for that space because that gives you the ability to help people develop and grow both before the meeting, which is critical, and then during the meeting, they can learn from that and then apply that moving forward, would be the big piece. So if you're not using technology like that, I would highly encourage it, because then at scale, you're giving real-time, always-on feedback to every single seller that you can, even in spaces where the manager, for example, might not always be there. Like, if you want to put full trust and autonomy in your seller, the manager is not going to always be there, right?
100%. I really appreciate that, and that makes a lot of sense. And one thing that I'm sort of thinking in a practical sense, and people sort of trying to apply these learnings to their own organizations, to their own teams, in terms of sort of objections that you've faced, not necessarily just in the project implementing the five shifts, but with sort of sales coaching projects in general, what are some of the sort of objections that you've sort of seen, and how do you overcome those? I'm thinking of someone who maybe listens to this, wants to sort of apply those, and then sort of hits that sort of objection and then doesn't know where to go from there. How do you sort of approach sort of various objections that do sort of tend to come up that you've seen in your experience?
Yeah, I mean, the main objection when we built the coaching program was the concept of, this is the manager's job. Like, why would we build a coaching team, you know, versus just, you know, hiring more sellers, right? And, you know, the argument in return to that was a little bit what I shared, which is, you know, kind of have a sense for what's actually happening in terms of manager responsibilities, and then how can we also support them, right? So it feels like there's a unified potential solution for it. Regardless of what the objection is, my encouragement is, you know, the key is to be proactive and do your homework to understand, as I think through and work through this, what do I believe the potential roadblocks will be, and how would I potentially respond to those roadblocks? So we kind of knew that was going to be a roadblock in advance. The other piece is, you know, think about, you know, how you would ask a seller to handle an objection no different. If you're trying to sell through or, you know, drive alignment on a particular program internally, you need to do additional discovery. Like, what are the potential objections? What's the undercurrent of that objection? And then based on that information, what's the right kind of path forward, knowing, you know, what you know already and what you might not know until you actually ask more questions. The other piece I would just offer is, you know, building the coaching program didn't happen overnight, right? So we started with a proof of concept. We started with one data point, which was the number of ineffective meetings we were seeing happening in the organization. We, you know, basically the ask was like, is this an important problem for us to solve and tackle? We then started working through a proof of concept. Once we did the proof of concept, we got some initial data points, and then we built a business case from there. So it wasn't like, you know, we showed up one day and said, hey, we want to build a coaching program, and it happened, right? It took, frankly, a couple of years to get it to where it is now, which is a fully fledged live program, global program.
That's really interesting. And yeah, Rome wasn't built in a day, and I don't think a big effective coaching program will be either. So that's really important to touch on as well. I'm cognizant of the time as well, so I do want to ask, in terms of sort of your biggest takeaway or learning that you sort of, if you would sort of want to leave onto someone who's listening or watching this, when it comes to coaching, how would you sort of, you know, one golden rule or sort of one big takeaway, what would sort of be your highlight for someone to take away from this? If they can only take one thing away from this episode, sort of what's that sort of key linchpin that you think they should latch onto and sort of bring back to their organization?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, the rule of three that I apply and I've, you know, really kind of banged the proverbial drum on is invest in coaching, practice, and feedback in your organization. I know it will look different depending on the size and scale of your org. Not every company is going to be able to, you know, hire a fully fledged coaching team. They might need to partner with different companies to do that, et cetera, or embrace it and embed it in different ways. But if you do not have a culture of coaching, practice, and feedback in your organization, I would make that an absolute P0 number one priority, because at the end of the day, if your sellers are out there, frankly, winging it, no matter how much experience they have, you run a ton of risk in terms of the deals and ability to close those. So that would be my parting words. And we have enough data out there now to prove that coaching has monumental impact.
I love that. And I think as good a parting sort of comment as I think anyone sort of could give. So I just want to say thank you, Jeff, for coming onto the show and taking the time to sort of share all that with our listeners. It was really valuable. I found it incredibly valuable. I'm 100% certain that our listeners will as well. So just thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, sure hope so. And thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to the Sales Enablement Innovation Podcast. Be sure to follow us on your podcast platform of choice so you don't miss a thing. And if you're hungry for more sales enablement content, visit our website, salesenablementcollective.com, for articles, events, and an easy way to join our Slack community, home to thousands of your sales enablement peers.